Welcome to Holden Village. Bruce Eklund will be speaking on child protection. Too much, too little, too soon, or too late. So let's listen in on Bruce.
What I'd like to do with this is to kind of give an overview of what the Children's Protection Service or system is, what it involves. And begin to look at some of the misunderstandings that are common about the system. And so the subtitle of Too Much, Too Little, Too Soon, Too Late depends upon what your perspective is. It seems like CPS is always missing the mark. Teachers often say when they're working with kids where abuse occurs and they call in a report, that it's there's too little and too late, and but often others, parents, there's a clamor that that CPS gets involved too soon and that they come in too heavy. A lot of that it comes from a misunderstanding in terms of exactly what the system is about. The status of the system, the whole system's underpinnings, the foundation, is from is a legal framework. Everything that CPS does is basically authorized by the law, and so what we end up with then are is a system that is designed to do certain kinds of things, but everybody has a different assumption as to what they want it to do, but the law often doesn't allow them to do those things. So with me, I have a good friend, Lynn Lichtenberg, who is an attorney general with the state of Washington, assistant attorney general in Everett, basically representing the state in child protective cases that are brought before the juvenile court. So she is going to help me with this process, basically, of getting some information out. What I'd like to do with it is maybe spend about a half an hour talking about the system and kind of giving you some information, and then we'll open it up for questions or issues or concerns that you may have. Kind of lay the foundation, just to give you the bigger, broader picture. The child protective system actually involves two whole systems, or legal systems. One is the dependency system, which is the civil process, and that's the system that Lynn works within in terms of dealing with the child abuse aspect in terms of the parent-child relationship and the abuse and neglect issues that go on there. There's a whole other system that we're probably that's more commonly known within our culture, and that's the offender system, which is the criminal justice system. And the purpose of that system then is to prosecute specific offenders and to provide some form of consequence in the way of taking away freedom of them is ultimately is what's at stake within the criminal justice system. This, and I should put up a dollar sign there, because that's another thing that we use there. The broader civil system, also the primary focus of the broader civil system is dollars. This is where the lawsuits primarily come from. The dependency portion of the civil process is not focused on dollars. It's essentially focused on this parent-child relationship and whether the parents continue to have control over or the ability to parent their children. The dependency or civil system here is a confidential system. The only persons who are allowed in the court hearings are the parties, and we'll talk a little bit more about who the parties are. The offender system or the criminal justice system is an open system, and anybody, regardless of whether they just are nosy, just kind of want to know what's going on, those are always open open systems, including the juvenile court. The juvenile justice process here is also, at least in the state of Washington, there may be some states where it's where the juvenile offender, the juvenile delinquency still falls under the civil side, but at least in Washington, it's on the it's in the criminal side. The process starts with some form of a complaint, with some form of a report on both sides. A report of a crime being committed, and if the crime is against a child, if the crime is by the parents against the child, then there's a protocol here between the law enforcement and CPS that if CPS gets the referral first and there is a crime that's being committed, that law enforcement, the Snohomish County Sheriff's Department, will be notified by the CPS worker. Likewise, if they get a criminal complaint that's against a child, then they will refer it over to CPS to investigate as to whether there's appropriate it's appropriate for them to investigate. So it starts with that complaint, and I think what I'll do is turn it over to Lynn at this point, and she can describe the process.
Go into a little bit more detail. As Bruce indicated, the purpose of the child protective system is to work with parents and children, or legal guardians, custodians. I'll just use the term parents, but it refers to any adult that is legally responsible for the child. And the primary purpose is to provide services to keep children safe in their own homes. If that's not possible, it's to provide temporary out-of-home placement with the goal to reunite families as soon as possible, with the third alternative, the disfavored alternative, to provide permanent out-of-home placement and eventually perhaps adoptions or guardianships or long-term foster care for kids that cannot be returned home safely. Usually CPS becomes involved because of referrals. It can be referrals from the police, it can be referrals from neighbors, teachers, relatives, just any number of people can make, anyone can make a referral to Child Protective Services intake. Every community has a hotline that you can call. The calls are screened there. Some people in our society are mandated to make referrals. The statutes outline who those people are, generally people that have a working relationship in a social service field, and teachers, doctors, etc. Anyone who makes a referral, if they make a referral in good faith, they're protected from any sort of repercussions of someone suing them for messing up their life by getting CPS involved in their life. So it's really better, from my point of view, to be on the safe side if you see something going on, to go ahead and call. The vast majority of referrals are screened out by CPS. Basically, they don't take any action. When referrals do come in, the intake worker will gather as much information as the person, generally it's a person calling on the phone, can give them. They use a risk matrix to determine what kind of response is appropriate. They try to gather information about the support networks that the family has. That goes into the risk matrix, if there's any criminal history, if there's any past CPS information, whether services have been offered in the past and have or have not been successful. And then the intake worker will determine the speed of response that's necessary. It can be immediate, 24 hours, 48 hours, a week, 60 days, just depending on the emergent nature of the referral. CPS, well, children can be taken into out-of-home placement in a variety of ways, but at no time can a CPS worker just go out to a house based on a referral and take a child out of the home. They don't have that kind of power. Neither would they want it. It either requires the parents to voluntarily sign a contract, and we just call those voluntary contracts. A parent can agree for whatever reason to place the child out of the home. Maybe the referral comes from the parent themselves requesting respite. I need a break. I'm falling apart. Can you take care of my kids for a little while? Those voluntary contracts can be terminated at any time by the parent. They can be for any period of time up to about 6 months is the limit in the state of Washington, and once in a while they get renewed for longer than that, particularly if an older child is in a residential treatment program or something like that, and the parties all feel like there's progress being made. They may not want to get the legal process involved. Another way children come into care is if the police have the power to take a child immediately. If they find, and I had to write down the standard for the police, so bear with me if I look it up. The police have to have, quote, probable cause to believe that the child is abused or neglected and that the child would be injured or could not be taken into custody if the parties had to wait for a court order. So the police even have very narrow range. They have to believe that the child has been abused or neglected and that the child would be endangered to further abuse, or perhaps the caretaker would abscond with the child, and so they couldn't find the child if they didn't take the child right then. Otherwise, they're supposed to go to court and get a court order. CPS workers can go to court with or without police information and ask the court for an order placing the child in protective custody. If CPS does that, they also have to file a petition and start this dependency process, which, as Bruce indicated, is a civil process. They're confidential. The parties are the parents, legal custodians, guardians, the child. A guardian ad litem may be appointed for the child, which is a special court-appointed advocate that represents the interests of the child only to the court. And the CPS DSHS is a party to those actions also.
CPS is a acronym for Child Protective Services, at least in the state of Washington, and DSHS is our Department of Social and Health Services, which is the agency under which CPS lies. And so there's different acronyms in different states, but most states have that same kind of structure where you have a CPS agency that lies underneath a larger social service agency.
And DSHS, of course, provides many more functions other than child protective services, but that's one piece of it. If CPS is going to go into court and ask the court to intervene in a family, it's because either there's an immediate danger that they do not believe they can deal with on a voluntary basis, or there have been myriad attempts at voluntary services that haven't worked, and they feel that to make progress with the family, they need the authority of the court to convince the adults to do whatever it is they think they need to do. Take parenting classes, take anger management classes, get into drug and alcohol treatment. Those are very, very common services that are provided, and CPS will try to provide those on a voluntary basis if possible, and go into court and get court orders if that's not possible. There are four criteria for dependency, and the Department of Social and Health Services can file under any of those. One is if the child has been abandoned. Basically, there's no parent or guardian around, which does happen sometimes. The ones you hear about in the paper are the infants left on the doorstep, but there are also teenagers that get abandoned. Their parents let them go live with a friend, and then poof, they're gone. The parents, like, where are they? I don't know. I haven't seen them for 6 months. We don't know where they live anymore. That happens too, and the adults that the child may be living with may feel like they need more authority to provide for the child, to give medical consents and things like that, and the department will come in and help out by filing there. Another section of the statute is if the child's been abused or neglected. Another section is if there's no parent capable, which doesn't mean that the child has been, quote, abused or neglected at that point, but there is a pattern of dysfunction in the family such that the child's welfare is endangered, either emotionally or physically, that their development will likely not go well if services aren't offered. And the final section, which are almost always agreed, well, they are always agreed now the way the statute reads, is for developmentally delayed children that are getting services from the Division of Developmental Disabilities, and some of that division's programs cannot be offered unless there is a dependency in place. So the parents will say, I need the state to come in and help me, and then those DSHS and the Division of Developmental Disabilities work together on those. But the two that we work with the most in the contested matters are if the child's been abused or neglected, or if we're alleging that there's no parent capable. Those petitions have to be filed immediately if the CPS worker without police want to take a child into protective custody. They have to do those two things together. Then the parents are notified immediately. The statute says within 24 hours of the child being taken. One would think maybe they would always be notified at the time, but often they're not home. A child's been left in an unsafe situation. There's a hearing within 72 hours. Parents are entitled to attorneys at those hearings. If they can't afford an attorney, they're entitled to an attorney at public expense, and they're given all that information the first time anyone can contact them, when they can be located. And CPS is mandated to make reasonable efforts to locate immediately. Then you get into the whole court scenario that plays itself out in one way or the other. Once dependency has been filed, the original shelter care hearing, the court has to find that there's reasonable cause to believe that the child's welfare would be endangered if not kept out of the home. And that's it's a very casual hearing, really. Even though there are attorneys there, the rules of evidence don't apply. Basically, anybody can tell the judge anything they want. Then, if the child is kept out of the home or even returned home, there's a trial set within 75 days, and that is a regular trial with the rules of evidence. The civil rules are different from criminal rules, but if you know about hearsay, that doesn't come in, and people testify, etc. The burden of proof is different in civil trials than criminal trials. Civil trials, we just have to prove our facts by a preponderance of the evidence, which basically means our facts are true. It's more likely than not that the facts are true. 51% is supposedly a preponderance, whereas I'm sure you're familiar with the criminal burden of proof is beyond a reasonable doubt, which is very difficult burden of proof. The civil cases in dependencies are tried only to a judge. There's no jury. Part of that is for confidentiality reasons, and part of it is because they are confidential, and the fewer people that are dealing with the family, the better it's believed for the family and their sense of privacy, because certainly what's being dealt with are very sensitive matters. If dependency is established, the state is mandated to make efforts to return children as home as possible throughout the proceedings. There are reviews at least every 6 months, more often than that. Usually any party can call a review for any reason. If the child continues to not be able to be returned home, if the parents either haven't complied with services that are ordered by the court, or they've complied with the services but it doesn't seem to have helped, the danger is still there, then the department has to make a permanent plan the department has to make a permanent plan anyway, but the primary permanent plan is always return home. If it's not possible, if it's looking like it's not possible return home, then the department has to make some other permanent plan, which is either a guardianship, preferably with relatives, but it can be with foster parents or other persons deemed suitable. Long-term foster care is not a preferred plan, but it is an acceptable plan under the statute, or termination of parental rights and adoption, which would follow that if at all possible. Both guardianships and termination of parental rights are whole new legal proceedings. They do follow. There are criteria that require that the child be dependent for at least 6 months before any of those are filed, but then there's a whole nother step with you have to prove that reasonable efforts have been made, all necessary services have been offered and provided, that there's little likelihood that the child can be returned home in the near future, or their parental deficiencies can be remedied, etc. And the burden of proof goes up. It It's an intermediary burden of proof. It's higher than preponderance. It's called clear, cogent, and convincing. It's a little easier than beyond a reasonable doubt, but it's still a higher burden of proof. And long-term foster care, there's no new proceeding for that. Actually, the statute requires that the department make a permanent plan for a child within 30 days of out-of-home placement. They do that, but at that stage, it is almost always return home. I mean, even if there's been horrendous abuse and people have serious doubts, I have not yet seen a plan that came out at 30 days that said terminate parental rights, because there's always that hope that something will stir in the parent to bring them around.
Isn't it true that you cannot even file the petition unless there's been at least 6 months?
So 6 months.
There has to be at least 6 months of services before the department can. And it's relatively uncommon. I mean, very seldom do they actually file within 6 months. We're talking
very
families
seldom.
That have been 2 years, 2 and 3 years in the process, and the kid needs to get on with his or her life, you know,
right.
And the parents are not. A couple of pieces, if I can just
interject
here, a couple of things that I think are real significant in understanding the system is that it's a meeting together of the social service system and the legal system. Legal system brings in some things that are significantly different from the social service system, and that's an adversarial process. The adversarial process is at the core of the legal system, of basically having strong representation on both sides going to a fact finder that then determines almost in a godlike fashion what the decision is going to be, and that's the role of the judge here. But it is this adversarial process, so the goal ultimately, the primary goal of DSHS, when they get this report here and they look at it, even if they screen it in and it's a serious kind of thing, the first thing that they attempt to do in their intervention as part of their investigation is to try and resolve it so that the child is protected, to gain kind of a connectedness with the parents, to offer resources to the parents in a way of preventing this stage right here. Once you get to this stage, or you have to remove the child, which immediately moves to this stage, it immediately it polarizes the case. So suddenly you have the parents seeing CPS as the enemy. Okay, whereas a majority of the cases that CPS actually deals with do not get to petitions being filed.
But those are the cases you always hear about.
That's right. That's true. And that's part of the misunderstanding. Mm-hmm. And it's also the ones where the parents, when it reaches that point, a lot of parents caught in that then become caught in the adversarial system and lose sight of what's in the best interest of the child. Because, again, if you're dealing with people who are struggling anyway, and all of a sudden this agency comes in, their sense, their gut level sense is to fight, you know, and it's difficult within the system to maintain that balance of being able to stay cooperative. It's one of the roles that the guardian ad litem then. See, the guardian ad litem doesn't come in until this point. A petition has to be filed before a guardian will be appointed. The guardian then comes in, and the first words out of their mouths when they meet the parents are, "I'm not part of DSHS, and I'm a volunteer." Okay, shh, you know, immediately kind of. And what the purpose of the guardian is then to kind of rehear the story, hear what the parents are saying, kind of hopefully take it out of some of that adversarial life, and to be able to identify and bring to the fore some of the parental goals and kind of get them back in touch with that and say, hey, you know, I don't think you're so far apart from the caseworker. This is what the caseworker is saying. And very often the role of the guardian can be one that can bring the case together and prevent there being a fact-finding hearing. The alternative to a fact-finding hearing is an agreed order. And again, most of the cases, is that still true?
Yep.
Most of the cases end up going agreed orders.
Absolutely.
Where you can work it through so you don't have to. This is a dirty laundry airing session. There's no other way of putting it. It's ugly. Because in order to make sure that you get the dependency that you need, you have to make sure that you have enough. Because you're also having the defense attorney minimizing all this stuff. And so in order to make sure that you get enough, you kind of have to bring everything out. And it's not a fun time. So you try for that agreed order where it brings you immediately down, you get an agreed plan, the parents say yes. And most parents, when that kind of thing happens, they kind of say, oh yeah, I'm overwhelmed. My parents just died, I just became unemployed. I mean, there's all kinds of reasons that happen. And if you can get beyond that adversarial and the fear of that adversarial process, then you can reach a point of cooperation and trying to get resources to there. A couple of things that affect that that are in relation to Jackie's class yesterday on the federal budget. Programs for children, programs to assist, programs to have available plans for people. The resources in the community are in jeopardy because of this program, because of the new budget, because of cutting out resources, a reshuffling kind of the deck. So community resources are critical here. You can't do it. You can't bring about change unless you can garner some support for the people. Churches can be a real significant role, or they can be a part of the problem. And sometimes churches become a part of the problem when they tend to take that adversarial stand on the part of the parent and try and justify the parent instead of helping the parent do what they need to do in order to get the child back. One other comment, and then we'll maybe open it up to some questions. There's a fork down here that Lynn talked about in terms of either it works towards dismissal or the child returning back home, or if the parents are not cooperative, it ends up going into termination. Most cases where it ends up going into termination, vast majority of them, the parents are kind of into the fight and into it as a, you know, they see that their task is to take on DSHS. And so what happens is they end up not complying. And it's like the parents are driving it this way because they don't comply, they don't do the kinds of things that are required of them, and it forces the hand. So this is that fork down there is a tragic. I don't know of a caseworker that does that cheerfully. There's certainly some times when you do it with some relief because this kid needs to get. Time goes faster for children than for us. You have a two-year-old, and 6 months for a two-year-old is a fifth of their life at that point. And so you have to get the thing moving. But it's certainly not done lightly. And the last part is there's lots of court checks. These are not where CPS comes out and just kind of has this incredible authority to take the kid out and the parents have no recourse. There's significant recourse, significant opportunities for parents to respond to the issues and to convince a judge of the inappropriateness of the situation.
And more often than not, if the social worker is doing their job, which, I mean, most social workers go into the field because they want to help. I mean, they're not in there to do battle. They're in there to keep kids at home, offer services, and their main frustration is that the services are not out there in sufficient number. So someone may have to wait for several months on a waiting list to get into drug alcohol treatment, or they may have to wait for several months to get into parenting, and the court order says they have to have these things before kids can be returned home. So those are major frustrations for social workers. But they are, as a whole, very dedicated professionals in the helping field. Like any other profession, there are good ones and bad ones, and you hear the horror stories that some are into the fight. But they have, my experiences, and I've been doing this for 9 years, they have great empathy for the parents. And one of the dangers I see, especially with newer social workers, and I've been there longer than they, is they have more empathy than they should for the safety of. And they are convinced these parents are going to come around now. And sometimes it's not true. And so, as Bruce says, the termination of parental rights is way down the road, 2-3 years, because everyone, judges included, want the parents to succeed. And sometimes because of their own past, they can't. And then that's very hard to accept because they're trying and they mean well. But little things tick them off and bam, the child's in danger again. Or they have a drug problem that's very difficult to kick. So those are...
I just wanted to comment on that. I work with an agency where one of our a social service agency where one of our programs is a program for abuse and neglected children. And all of our cases are referred to us by CPS, and it's in this state. Over the last 8 years, we've been looking at the types of parents we've had, and close to 90% have been either alcoholics or drug abusers. So it's not just about evil people. Many of these people, when they're sober, are good people. But they've got, they're into a terrible kind of addiction. And we see some of them come to us, their child comes to us, and we serve that child, and the child goes back home, the parents have been through a treatment program, and then 6 months or a year later, the same kid comes back again. And that's the question, I guess, of how many times they have to hit bottom. And I mean, it's just like anyone else who's a substance abuser. And the unfortunate thing is that the kid or kids are in the middle of this. So I wouldn't want you to have the picture. We feel we're there to protect the kid. We're not a part of the state, but we're protecting the kid, and that's our first priority. But we do see parents who do recover and who go on to be very good parents. So I don't want to paint this picture that it's all totally hopeless and all these evil people out there. It's unfortunately substance abuse to a large extent.
Right. Yeah, substance abuse, I think that was one of the keys that really weaves itself through all of the child abuse and neglect issues. Something that you had talked about that is a significant part of that too is that this plan. Here you're dealing with, you're working with people who are struggling. I mean, that's even a compliment. I mean, they're dysfunctional. They don't have a good support system. They don't have the resources to be able to do what they need to do, which is just to kind of stay level, okay? And all of a sudden, this system happens to them. They come down to a disposition plan. They have parenting classes they have to take. They have, if their child's in foster care, they have to make it to visitation. They have to, maintain some kind of employment or some kind of stable home in order to have the child ultimately come back to them. They may have anger management classes that they need to attend as well, and there's an attend AA meeting. So all of a sudden, boom, there's this thing that most normal people would kind of go under with the amount of things asked of these people. And so part of the goal of the system, of the guardian ad litem, of the caseworker, is to come up with a sequence of that plan. And I've never known a case to go to termination where the parents were trying and were asking for help, basically, and really making the effort. The state doesn't want these kids to be in permanent foster care.
They're mentally ill.
Unless they can't make it. Right.
Yeah.
But, I mean, part of the burden of the state at that point, for people who are mentally ill or some form of disability, is offering services, at their level, whatever their incapacity is, that they have access to. And if it's a mental incapacity, of making sure that the parenting classes come in at first grade level. And that's a burden ultimately that the state has in terms of offering those services where the person is, and not assuming some kind of standard. The other thing, a commonly misunderstood part of the system, these kids get placed in foster cares, and most foster cares or foster homes is an improvement for them. There's some stability there, there's some structure, there are some abusive foster homes too, that's a whole other issue, but most of the foster homes, there's pretty rigorous screening, and so when kids get into foster care, it's a whole different lifestyle for them. And often teachers or maybe the person who made the referral and the kid gets into this foster home can begin to see some progress in this kid, okay? Because there's more structure around them. And then the parent who's been operating at an F level, okay, kind of begins to get some of their stuff together. They move up to a D level, okay? Okay, that's all they have to be in order to get out of the system. They don't have to become A or B plus parents. So part of the misunderstanding in terms of that, again, that too much, too little, too soon, too late type of thing, is the kid then when the parents finally pull it together, get their stuff together, enough to kind of get across that line where then the child's returned to them. And the parent, the teachers see some of the, you know, that kind of dips down there because there's still a lot of problems within the parenting and within that family. But again, that's a legal mandate, is that it's not, I mean, the goal of the whole system is to return them home as soon as possible. And there's some value in that, because where the child belongs is home. That any time you make a decision to place a child in foster care, using a baseball image, you're like putting them up to the plate with two strikes. That there is harm that comes with foster care. Definition. There is harm with moving the child out of that central family where they identify, where they have bonded, even if it's a bonding to the violence or bonding to the dysfunction, where they have, but they still have a sense of care for those people. It's a place that they belong. You move the child out, and it breaks up that for the child. So there's, you can't do that thing lightly. And you have to pay attention to the issues of the bonding.
Has there been any research on that? I mean, as far, because I mean, that goes against, as a teacher, everything that I, you know, I've seen this too often where these kids have gone back. And I mean, we've watched them grow up, and it's been, I think, a big failure. I really makes me sad in many cases.
Research on which question?
I guess I'd like to know, when you put somebody in a good foster home, let's say a first or second grade, you're saying still that it's in the long run, that child's not going to function as an adult as well as if you return him to a slightly improved dysfunctional
family. No, I didn't say
that. Okay, maybe I didn't agree right. Talk about that a little more.
Initially, the movement of them out of their home is a traumatic experience to that child, by definition.
But I'm speaking, what if they get into a foster home that's really good and stay there? In the long run, would their chances of being successful adults be better than... Because too many times I've seen them put back real fast. Yeah. And I know because they've grown up, and they're the ones that have been arrested in our neighborhood.
I think it's uncertain.
Okay.
There's evidence on both sides, because kids who stay in foster care is not a good place for kids to grow up, because of that sense of belonging. It's a place, and that's there's a couple of factors here. Remember, we talked about these two systems: the social service system and the legal system. What drives the social service system is the legislature.
Mm-hmm.
Is the bucks. Okay, so the capabilities of the system, I've noticed within the last 10 years, and I'm sure Lynn has too, that this point right here has really changed. There's a prioritization that happens that Lynn talked about, and it used to be that about a third of them would go down to be investigated, and now it's down to less than a fifth. Of the cases, most of them are screened out, and it's not that there isn't some concern.
Mm-hmm.
It's that there are not resources.
Okay.
And the other piece of it is that there's been an increase in our culture of personal safety curriculums in schools and awareness of people, and so there's at the same time as there's an increase in referrals, there's a decrease in resources. And I mean, actually a physical decrease. DSHS over the last 10 years is smaller, has fewer caseworkers and fewer resources than they did 10 years ago. And yet the referrals are, at least in Somers County, I think they're about 600 a month referrals.
I think
reports that they get. And it used to be about 300 or between 300 and 350, with roughly a third neglect, a third sexual abuse, and a third physical abuse. And those figures have kind of skewed since too.
Mm-hmm.
Can I ask a question of information? Now you're in Somers County. What if the parent picks up and goes over to Yakima? What happens then? Is there record following?
There is, and it depends on what type, how thorough the referrals are and coordination between the counties.
Because I'm also a teacher, and I have had a case where a mother, as I looked in the records, every year moved someplace else.
It depends on what stage they have been in the system. DSHS now is on a statewide system where any social worker in the state can look up a family name, and if there has been prior CPS in the state, they will know that, but that doesn't go back too many years. if it's in the legal system, there's tight coordination.
Yeah, no, this never got, see, it never got there because it just,
right,
knew about how to move.
It varies if they're not.
That's a pretty common occurrence, and I think teachers recognize that. As soon as systems begin to get connected with the kids, the parents get scared. The parents end up moving. And it's one of the ways that they perceive of protecting themselves from the intervention of their system.
Along those lines, I reported maybe 5 families to CPS as a teacher and as a neighbor, just as a citizen of the world. I live from Whitman County, which is right near the Idaho border, and 2 of those families just moved 8 miles away, and everything was gone.
Mm-hmm. And you don't know whether, I mean, the department can communicate with other states, but it's...
The CPS worker is a good friend of mine, but he said there's nothing we can do, because they're in Idaho now, and Idaho's money and state areas is just really bad.
Because they can call and they can send records, but if they have no faith that anything's going to happen, they may not even do that.
Well, plus they don't know where the families move. You know, we hear that they moved to Idaho, but...
Oh, if you don't know the county.
Oh, yeah, if you don't know where.
Yeah.
I want to say that in private social service agencies like mine, and there are many others in this state and in other states, we try to, it's kind of walking on the fence, try to walk the narrow line between, we're advocates for the kids, but on the other hand, we certainly are not against the parents in these cases. And in many situations, we find that we can be on a more positive basis with the parents than the state agency can. And we didn't used to look at it that way, but more and more we are. And the end result is that often we'll have, even though our services, we've got full-day services for young kids who've been abused. Parallel to that, we're also running parenting classes and those kinds of things while the parents are in substance abuse training. And that seems to work fairly well, and the parents tend to stay put more. The problem, we're serving, my agency serves a 6-county area in this part of the state, and we have 39 places for such children, and obviously there's far more than that. And the end result, when a caseworker from CPS has a case, they may have to wait in line for a long time to get one of those. But that's because of the priorities that the people in Olympia and Washington, D.C. have right now on how that's some of the very money that's being cut. And it doesn't come out that way. They don't say we're cutting money for abused children. But some of the Medicaid cuts, a major chunk of our funding for this particular service comes out of federal Medicaid money, which is being cut, so inevitably we're going to have less than 39 of these spaces.
The interesting thing is that the struggle, at least as I view it within our culture right now, is between responding to violence, responding to crimes that are being committed, and the effect and looking at putting more resources into prisons, more resources into the criminal justice system. In Snohomish County, the criminal justice system already takes up 60% of the budget. In Snohomish County, and I think most other counties are that way, because the counties have the cost of the courts and the jail and the juvenile court, at least in the state of Washington.